My take-home message, obviously, is to steer clear of these fad diets. In the book, I talk about what's appropriate, the type of weight that you need to lose, the gradual, carefully thought-out weight loss programs that avoid rapid weight loss and just really do normal weight loss, you know, gradually, that's safe for your body and safe for your baby.
We're talking today with Dr. Jennifer Weider, the author of The New Mom Survival Guide. You have a chapter, Jennifer, called Your New Self, and you talk a lot about ways women can cope with loneliness that comes up being isolated as a new mom. And one of the areas I appreciated seeing in there was a section about how to maintain connections with childless friends, which I think is often a real challenge from both sides of the equation.
It is, and I think that, you know, for me, this was a challenge, and I never found anything written about this topic. You know, women oftentimes are very isolated and lonely, and I think that if you have a friend that doesn't have a baby, you almost have a disconnect, an emotional disconnect. You can have a physical disconnect because it's difficult to see your friend and stay in touch with them. You know, a lot of women experience this sense of detachment from their friends that don't have children, and it's so important to try to connect with your friends, whether they have babies or children or not. You know, I offer some tips in the book, like, you know, limit the baby talk when you see your friends without kids, you know, that you can't really understand what it's like to have a child or that connection. You know, it's always so funny. You know, I always visualize someone putting a child on the phone, listening to baby gurgle and jabber and gibberish when, you know, that may be great for the grandmother, but for your friend without a baby, listening to that for, you know, more than 30 seconds is, you know, your friend really will not be able to connect to that. And also, I think it's important to maintain your independence and your autonomy. Get a babysitter, leave the baby. You know, you can leave the baby at home with a sitter. You don't have to take the baby to social events. You can go out with your single friends or your childless friends and not feel guilty about that. It's so healthy to maintain those friendships. And you want to set aside time to stay connected, because the more connected you are with a larger breadth of friends, whether they have children or not, it really contributes to a good, solid emotional state of being and a good well-being for you, you know. And it's not, you know, you don't want to neglect those friends, because they were friends before and you have a lot in common. Just because you became a mom doesn't mean you can lose it. You know, you have to lose that connection.
And finally, you discuss an issue that I'm sure is relieving for a lot of women, to discuss the issue of sex and sexuality post-birth, something that I imagine a lot of people might be reluctant to bring up with their doctors.
And I think that's a good point, actually. I think this is probably the question that you wouldn't want to discuss with your doctor unless you had a glass of wine. A lot of women have a lot to say about this topic, and I think that this topic can be very frustrating for men and women after they had, you know, a very active sex life, after the baby comes due to hormonal reasons, due to physical reasons, whether it's an episiotomy or a difficult labor and delivery, whether it's a psychological block. Sometimes the sex life will suffer post-pregnancy. I've spoken to women that have had an incredibly active sex life, you know, several weeks after the baby was born, and I've spoken to other women that have not engaged in sexual intercourse with their partner up to 12 months later. So it varies. The spectrum really varies. You know, it's all individual. You know, my best piece of advice is open communication with your partner. Oftentimes, you know, the dad is going to feel marginalized a lot. You know, the connection between the baby and the mom is a very strong connection. And for a lot of men, they feel on the periphery, they feel marginalized, and then they feel, you know, disconnected from their wives from both a sexual and physical intimate level, but also an emotional level. So even if you don't engage in sexual intercourse, you know, I found just speaking to women that connecting with their husband, whether cuddling or kissing, you know, you can maintain that connection and then to try to work through some of the issues, because there are physical roadblocks there, and I go through a lot of them in the book. Hormonally, you know, women have issues with just feeling ready to have sex. Their bodies may not be ready, you know, just from a physical standpoint. They may have a psychological issue. If they've had a tough labor and delivery, it's difficult to imagine having intercourse. So open and honest communication between partners is so important, because you can get over those humps together. Isolating yourself and not communicating, you know, if your husband or your partner is making advances and you keep continuously push them off, it's going to develop a rift, which unfortunately can extend into your emotional life as well.
Well, Dr. Weider, where can people find the New Woman Survival Guide if they're interested in learning more?
You know, you can, I have a website. It's drwider.com. That's drwider.com. And the book is also available on amazon.com.
And do you have any final thoughts for our listeners today?
No, you know, I think it's really important. I think that women need to focus in on themselves. And I think that the most important thing that people can take from this talk or from my book is that, you know, women are the caretakers for their family. They're responsible for the health and well-being of their partners, their children, often their aging parents, and their issues can get lost in the shuffle. So just tuning in, fine-tuning in to paying attention to your body and not to ignore any symptoms that may be interfering with your daily life is so important.
Well, it was a pleasure having you on Health Watch today.
Thanks so much.
We're talking today with Dr. Jennifer Wider, the author of The New Mom Survival Guide, How to Reclaim Your Health, Your Sanity, and Your Sex Life After Having a Baby. Stay tuned for the rest of the Monday Morning Radio Zine.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fagrang. I'm sitting in for Scott Forrester, who can't be here today for Monday on the Environment. But Scott will be with us later this week. He'll be hosting a special program on the crimes of the Bush administration Friday at 10 a.m. My gosh, that could be a three-hour special, but I think it's probably only an hour or half an hour. Anyway, so I am here, and we're going to be talking about an environmental issue with the Columbia River crossing, and I think we have on the line Ron Buell. Good morning. Ron, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, welcome to KABU.
Thank you.
Now, you started Willamette Week back in the day, and you've been involved with kind of local and state politics for a long time.
That's right.
And the thing you're involved with now is a Columbia River crossing, which is coming up for a critical vote Wednesday. And tell us a bit about this bridge. It's going to replace the bridge over the Columbia, the I-5 bridge.
Yeah, actually, there are two bridges there, mm-hmm. aren't there? And what is being proposed is a $4.2 billion 12 to 14 lanes of highway bridge and $1 billion worth of mega ramps way up in the air, 60, 70 feet in the air, because this bridge has to go be high enough so the ships can go under it in the minds of the builders. And so we're talking about 35 acres of concrete, and we're talking about what amounts to $8,000 for every family of four in the metro area, if you're talking about $4.2 billion. And so it's a lot of money, and it's the biggest public works project in the history of the region and the biggest single project. And so we're there's a group of us who don't think a replacement bridge is a good idea at this point in time, given $4 a gallon gas. Mm-hmm. And we've been working hard to try and to convince Metro and the Portland City Council, which are two local bodies that have to approve it in order for it to go forward. We're trying to convince them to pause, take some time out, and think about this and not rush forward and make a decision that everybody is going to regret. And believe me, everybody will regret it if we go forward on this very wasteful, very large enterprise.
Well, 12 lanes, that'd be 6 lanes in each direction crossing the river?
Yeah.
My gosh, that's a lot.
It's a lot, but that doesn't count the $1 billion worth of mega ramps that are up in the air that are on go east and west in both directions from the bridge that they're planning to replace the current on and off ramps in what they call the bridge impact area. I mean, this is a big cotton picking project, and so we're hoping that we can get them to pause and rethink and reconsider. We don't think they can finance it, for one thing. We don't think they can put the money together to do this. You know, the Bush administration has pretty much trash-canned the Highway Trust Fund. A lot of it has gone instead to Iraq, surprisingly enough. And so the old days of 90% federal money are no more. So they're planning instead to borrow a lot of money, to bond the state and local match, and to bond the tolls that they plan for the bridge, and so they can have the money up front for construction, so that we'll be going into debt as a region, and the bondholders will want to make sure they get their money. And so they're going to come first, ahead of dealing with global warming, ahead of dealing with peak oil, and trying to build a transit system and to get a more dense, compact community that where people can walk and bicycle and take transit and don't have to get in their car to go everywhere. So that's if we go forward and we actually were successful in having hundreds of millions of dollars of interest that we would have to pay every year in debt, it's a big mistake for the region. Because we're going to give those bondholders the power to take all of our transportation money.
They're first in line, then. Right?
They're first in line,
okay.
And that'll be a real problem for us.
What happened? What if, for some reason, not enough people pay tolls? Who gets stuck?
Well, the money that would go for transit or roads, and there are some legitimate road needs where we have real projects that people have been planning for a long time. You know, there's a $7 billion backlog in the region of projects that have been approved that are on the books for the region. And things like the Selwood Bridge, which nearly everybody seems to feel we need to do something there. I do. And so that gets put on hold. I mean, so the costs to the region are not just spending all this money on a bridge where they have overestimated the need for it, significantly overestimated the need, and they have significantly underestimated the traffic. And so the DEIS, the draft environmental impact statement that they produced, will not pass muster under the National Environmental Protection Act. So if there's a court case that's brought against the ODOT and WSDOT and the Columbia River crossing, if there's a case that's brought in court, the courts will surely overturn this decision to build a big replacement bridge based on the shoddy work that's been done. You know, what they basically have done is predetermined. There's a really strong lobby for this project, and they predetermined the outcome and wrote a draft environmental impact statement that gets them to where they want to go, instead of taking a real look at the situation. So the Oregon Trucking Association and the Portland Business Alliance and the Columbia Pacific Building Trades Council, these folks have put together an incredible campaign that has won the governors of both states and the Oregonian and the Portland Tribune as big supporters of the project. And so when you have that kind of political force, that kind of political pressure coming down on Metro and the city, it makes it more difficult for people to ask the tough questions, to stand up to that force, and to make sure that the planning is appropriate under the National Environmental Protection Act. And I'm here to tell you that it hasn't been appropriate, mm-hmm. that they haven't done their job, and I can be specific about that.
One thing that really makes me wonder is that they are basing their projections on a very low price of gasoline.
Yeah, $1.25 a gallon.
$1.25 a gallon. We'll never see that again.
$4 now, and it's headed nowhere but up if you listen to people who understand the national and international status of the oil market.
Why did they do that? I mean, is it...
Well, it's just old stuff, and things have changed around us in the last few years, in the last few months, actually, because... $4 gas seems to be a paradigm shift for people, and so you have the traffic on the existing bridges have actually went down from March of 2007 to March of 2008. The traffic went down by 3%. Well, they're projecting, of course, 40% growth in traffic in the next 30 years, not in the next 25 years, by 2030, 22 years, that is. So the point is that they used the old gas numbers, and they haven't, you know, when you ask them about it, it's prevarication, it's mendacity, it's part of their campaign to ignore that. And the same thing is true of the requirement that they have a low-cost alternative, which is in the state law. So, you know, they're supposed to come up with an alternative that is the lowest cost possible. So Metro asked for an arterial bridge that would handle the local traffic and get the local traffic and light rail and bicycle and pedestrians off the interstate bridges so that the freight could move more easily on those bridges, because a lot of the traffic is local, and it's just going a short distance. It gets on or off on the three interchanges on the both the south and the north. There are three interchanges in what they call the bridge impact area, and there. So, you know, a lot of the traffic goes off or on from those interchanges. And so, the point is, if you had a local bridge, you'd free up the movement for freight, and you could do it for a lot less, and you could earthquake proof these bridges so they'd withstand a 2,500-year earthquake for less than $200 million, and you could build the transit that you want to build, and you'd have some additional lanes of traffic, so you could use that arterial bridge to free up the situation for freight, and you wouldn't have to build all this $1 billion worth of mega ramps. And so there is no low-cost alternative, because the state ODOT and WashDOT, the State Departments of Transportation, the so-called highway departments, they said, no, we won't spend the money if that's what we're going to do, is an arterial bridge. And so they wouldn't bring forward for Metro and the city to look at a low-cost alternative. Well, under the state law, they're supposed to do that in Oregon and Washington. And then there's this whole problem of greenhouse gas, which frankly, I say they've lied about it. I mean, other people would say, well, it's not a lie. It's a prevarication. What they say is that the greenhouse gas emissions from the big new bridge will actually go down from the no build. And the way they justify that is they say in their work that by speeding up the traffic through the bridge impact area, there'll be less greenhouse gas emitted. Well, that ignores all the scientifically proven second-level effects of building a big new bridge, such as induced travel. The last time we built capacity across the Columbia was in 1982 when we built the Glen Jackson Bridge. We completed it, and when they were doing the planning for that, they said they projected traffic out for 2000 and 2005 across the bridge, And that was 50% below what actually happened, because they didn't change the land use, just like they haven't changed the land use between the no build and the big new bridge for their planning purposes. So they plan for no induced travel as a result. Well, there's 6,000 acres that are ready, sitting there in Clark County, ready to be developed for housing and for the undeveloped farm and forest land within the cities and the urban growth areas of the smaller suburban fringe cities in Clark County, cities like Ridgefield and Battleground and so forth. And those cities have all this land awaiting development, Ridgefield, Battleground, La Center, Yacolt, Three Rivers, etc. And so those smaller cities have this area. If the bridge is built, that housing will be built. If it's not built, the housing won't be built. If you don't build a big new bridge, then they're not going to be able to develop that. Well, why is that? Because the higher gas prices has taken down suburban housing in the value of it all over the nation.
Right.
So here in Portland, the Portland region has the suburbs having a decline in value of suburban housing of about 15%, whereas the strong inner core cities like Portland and all over the country, they're even in the credit crunch. You know, my house in Irvington is worth the same amount now as it was when the credit crunch hit. It's basically the value has basically stayed stable in the, well, in the suburbs is where it's fallen, because people don't want to pay $4 a gallon for gas and commute all the way to work.
Right.
There's a lot of people who commute. There's, if you count the people coming over both bridges, it's 65,000 people who commute from Clark County today to jobs in Portland. And Clark County has a jobs ratio that is 50% less than the per capita than the rest of the regions, and so it's a big commuter area. They have great schools over there. They have really nice suburban development, and so they get a lot of people to live there, but there are not a lot of jobs over there. And so basically we're feeding this big new replacement bridge feeds the developers in Clark County, but the suburban politics are changing because of the gas price, and so that's not accounted for in the plans for this big new bridge, and it's basically the economics have changed, and the marketplace has changed, and we still have a big lobby effort to get this thing done that the governors of both states are supporting, and the Oregonian and the Tribune are supporting. And so we see a paradigm shift occurring. The Sustainable Development Commission of the City of Portland says, hey, we ought to wait and take a look and see what's going to happen here. They recommended that the city council not rush to judgment. And that's what our group is saying, is, look, you guys, if you do rush to judgment, there'll be a NEPA challenge, and the courts are going to toss it out. And if you wait and finish the analysis on the greenhouse gas and finish the analysis on the induced travel, what they're worried about, of course, is that that's going to prove they don't need the big new bridge.
Mm-hmm. What about, there was a report that just was in the paper today.
That's exactly on point, isn't it? Because what Dylan Rivera reported, and he's done a good job of covering this, it's just that their editorial writers don't read the news stories. I mean, what he basically said is that congestion isn't going to go down by their own studies. It's still going to be congestion even if you build this big new bridge. There's still going to be plenty of congestion.
It'll just move
to another location. And of course, that's a scientific thing, isn't it? I mean, you know, if all lean manufacturing is is based on the idea of eliminating bottlenecks, and everybody who understands manufacturing processes today understands that if you, in a process like traffic movement, if you clean out a bottleneck, the bottleneck moves down the road. Well, we aren't spending any money on the big bottleneck we have at where I-5 hits the I-84, the band.
Oh, that's a huge bottleneck there.
It's a huge one, and we're not spending money on fixing that. There are no big plans. Mm-hmm. You know, they're studying it, but I mean, so what this is going to do is all the cars coming from the north and all the additional traffic coming from the north are going to make that bottleneck that happens at the Rose Quarter now. It's going to substantially.
Mm-hmm.
So the congestion that they argue they're going to get rid of with this. I mean, because the whole purpose and need statement for this big new $4.2 billion bridge is let's reduce congestion in this choke point. Well, it's just moving it down the road, It's just moving it elsewhere. And so there's a front page story. So it's hard to believe that a lobby can put together a campaign like these guys have put together, and that it can overcome the facts in the political world. We don't like to believe that we have a political process in Portland that is at the mercy of special interest groups who benefit and profit from that kind of a political process. We like to believe that we're building a smart, sustainable, growing city, and mm-hmm. and that's compact and dense, and where driving is not necessary. And
that's
and
our reputation around the world.
It certainly is. We're nation leading, and mm-hmm. and so how does Ted Kulongoski say, well, we want to lead the nation in reducing greenhouse gases? That's what he said in the Oregonian. That's a direct quote
mm-hmm.
From 2 weeks ago. That's what he said. And how does he do that? And then, in the same breath, support a 12-lane, $4.2 billion bridge to add highway capacity?
Wow.
Because 35% to 40% of the greenhouse gas emissions come from transportation, from fossil fuel use by automobiles. And, you know, the freight guys, they want to have these big new ramps that serve the areas like Jubitz Truck Stop and the port areas on both sides of the river in Vancouver and Portland and Rivergate and so forth. They want those to be served by these big new ramps, which will make their lives a lot easier. But they don't recognize that what's going to happen is you're just going to get a lot more single occupancy vehicles on the highway from this development in Clark County, and it's going to get congested again, as Dylan Rivera reported mm-hmm. in the Oregonian today. So, you know, the lobbies keep going ahead full steam. they keep going. The special interest money keeps going. So this is a very important decision that's going to be made on Wednesday at 2 p.m. in the Portland City Council.
Mm-hmm.
And we're urging people to come out and join us to ask our politicians to wait and consider a lower-cost alternative and a supplemental arterial bridge for local traffic and light rail. And so we're hoping that Dan Saltzman and Nick Fish and Sam Adams and Randy Leonard and Tom Potter get what's going on here and pause. And you know what? I think they will. I really am confident that the lobby is not going to carry the day.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just slightly fearful that I may be wrong.
Well, we're talking with Ron Buell about the Columbia River crossing. You know, so I sort of see a nightmare scenario. They build this bridge, and then by the time it's finished, gasoline is $10 a gallon, and all these homes that are built out in these outer suburbs are empty the way they are empty in Southern California right now. And so you have what they call stranded development. You have sort of like ghost towns out there out in the suburbs. And here's this big, massive bridge, and who would it be used by? You know, I don't know.
Do you remember the Whoops decision? in the 1980s, you go back that far.
And, oh yes.
This is kind of like that. I mean, mm-hmm. people said our demand for electricity is going to do nothing but go up, up, and up. And of course, in this region, we've learned to conserve and to insulate our houses and use less energy. And as a result, it hasn't gone up and up and up. And you know, so the biggest bankruptcy in the history of the United States on those nuclear plants that were partially built. I mean, you have another situation that is very much like that, and it is a nightmare scenario. It's a nightmare scenario for the region because we only have so much money with which we can build a transit system that's competitive with the automobile. And I'm talking about one that serves a network or a system of origins and destinations. All the work and shopping places that exist all over this region, I mean, they aren't concentrated downtown anymore. It's not like that anymore. And so we need to have a transit network that is really a network and a system, not just a corridor out to Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And we also need to have more density, more compact growth in occurring in the inner city, so that there are more people who, you know, because what happens is the people who are on the economic margins are the ones that get hit hardest by the cost of gasoline. I mean, face it, if you got a job and you're commuting to it now and you're living a long distance, the gasoline prices are eating your lunch,
mm-hmm.
and it's causing you to rethink whether or not you should be riding a bike or riding a motorcycle or taking the bus. And so transit ridership all over the country is up dramatically. So why would we spend when we need to build a transit network that operates in a grade separated way so that it's operating as if it were an automobile in terms of the speed with which it goes. I mean, how long does it take you from Vancouver to Union Station by rail?
I tried a trip from Hillsboro to downtown Portland, and from Hillsboro to Goose Hollow went real fast because you're off the streets and you could have five-car trains if you wanted to. As soon as you get to Goose Hollow, you're on the city streets, and, of course, you have the short city blocks, and,
we're building a transit mall that is going to mix the automobiles mm-hmm. and the light rail and the buses all together would make it even worse downtown in terms of time. And it takes 23 minutes to get from Goose Hollow to the Lloyd Center today,
right. mm-hmm.
or vice versa. And you know, that's not competitive with the automobile. Even in a congested downtown like the one we have, it's not competitive with the automobile. And we need times, we need subways, we need L's like they have in Vancouver, B.C., where, you know, through the busy areas, the transit isn't mixed in with the automobiles. Our transit system has been going in a absolutely the opposite and wrong direction, and we need a whole bunch of money to do this, to build subways and L's, and to have a competitive with the automobile transit system for people who can't afford to spend what it costs for oil. And you know, those of us who are waiting to own our Priuses and are stuck with the gas guzzlers, try and resell them to get a Prius and discover that, hey, the SUV or the pickup is a glut on the market and you're not going to get the price that you want for it. And so you'd like to be in line in the 3-month line at Broadway Toyota to get a Prius, and you know your brother just bought one for, and he's getting 47 miles a gallon, and you know it's costing him half as much for gas as it does you, or you're in a jam because you don't have the money to do that. So all I'm trying to say is this situation is going to do nothing but get worse, because it's gasoline is $8 a gallon in England, and it'll be here soon someday in Canada, and $200 a barrel oil is
not far away.
It's not far away. Unfortunately, it's going to come sooner rather than later. 2008 or 2009, and we'll be at $200 a barrel. Now that's only up from 143, it hit yesterday, the other day, and that's not even a 50% increase, and we've tripled in the last 4 years.
I think we're going to have to end it here right now. We're talking to Ron Buell about the Columbia River crossing, which is coming up for a vote on the Portland City Council Wednesday at 2 p.m. So can people go down there and they can sign up to talk about it?
Well, it'd be great if they would.
Uh-huh.
Thanks a lot for the opportunity to chat with you about this today.
Well, thanks for being available.
Talk to you later.
Okay, and City Hall Wednesday at 2 p.m. So this is Per Fagring signing off, and stay tuned for Democracy Now!
Once more laid down by the hungry hand, how long can you give and not receive and feed this world through my
Good morning. The time is now 11 o'clock on Monday. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM on your FM dial, 91.9 FM in Hood River, the Dalles, and the Columbia Gorge, 100.7 FM in Corvallis and Albany. We're also on the web at www.kboo.fm. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from RadioCab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. RadioCab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212, in Vancouver at 360-694-1234, or radiocab.net. And now stay tuned for Democracy Now!
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
They were copying everything flowing across the internet cables. And the major internet links between AT&T's network and other companies' networks.
Former AT&T technician Mark Klein, the man who blew the whistle on the involvement of phone companies in the Bush administration's domestic spy program, will join us as the Senate prepares to vote on a measure to amend the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Then a major decision in Canada. A federal court rules sending a soldier back to the United States when he was in that the war in Iraq is in violation of international law and that they would reconsider his asylum claim. We'll speak with the soldier, Joshua Key, and his attorney. Then to Gaza. We'll speak with award-winning Palestinian journalist Mohammed Omar. He was hospitalized after being strip-searched and assaulted by Israeli guards at a border crossing between Jordan and the West Bank. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Afghanistan, at least 40 people have died after a suicide car bomber rammed two diplomatic vehicles outside the Indian embassy in Kabul. It was the deadliest car bombing in Afghanistan this year. Over 140 people were injured. The gates of the Indian embassy were blown off, and the walls and buildings inside the compound were also damaged by the force of the blast. The U.S. military is being accused of killing as many as 49 Afghan civilians in a pair of separate airstrikes over the weekend. On Sunday, local officials in eastern Afghanistan said a U.S. airstrike killed 27 civilians at a wedding party. The dead included the new bride as well as many women and children. Meanwhile, Afghan President Hamid Karzai has ordered an investigation into a separate U.S. helicopter strike that reportedly killed up to 22 civilians on Friday. The United States military has disputed the accounts of both airstrikes. The Associated Press reports the Justice Department is considering letting the FBI investigate Americans without any evidence of wrongdoing, relying instead partly on racial or ethnic profiling. Currently, FBI agents need specific reasons, such as evidence or allegations that a law probably has been violated, to investigate U.S. citizens and legal residents. The Council on American-Islamic Relations has decried the plan as unconstitutional and un-American. Other critics have compared the proposed guidelines to the FBI's now-defunct COINTELPRO operation under J. Edgar Hoover in the 50s and 60s. Senator Barack Obama has suggested he's willing to refine his campaign promise to remove all combat troops within 16 months of becoming president. On Thursday morning, Senator Obama discussed his views on Iraq in Fargo, North Dakota.
When I go to Iraq and I have a chance to talk to some of the commanders on the ground, I'm sure I'll have more information and we'll continue to refine my policies.
Hours later, Obama held an impromptu press conference to insist his statement did not reflect a change in policy.
That position has not changed. I have not equivocated on that position. I am not searching for maneuvering room with respect to that position.
Meanwhile, Obama has told a Christian magazine he supports a ban on late-term abortions as long as there's an exception for the physical health of the mother. But Obama said mental distress should not qualify as justification for late-term abortions. Obama said, quote, "I don't think that mental distress qualifies as the health of the mother. I think it has to be a serious physical issue that arises in pregnancy where there are real significant problems to the mother carrying that child to term." A Canadian court has sided for the first time with a U.S. war resister who fled to Canada seeking refugee status. Federal Court Justice Richard Barnes ordered the Immigration and Refugee Board to reconsider the failed refugee claim of Joshua Key, who fled to Canada in 2005. Barnes said Key had witnessed enough human rights abuses during a stint in Iraq that he could qualify for asylum. The judge also concluded military action against civilians in Iraq violates the 1949 Geneva Convention. We'll speak with Joshua Key as well as his attorney later in the broadcast. The Guardian newspaper has obtained an unpublished World Bank report that found biofuels have caused world food prices to increase by 75%. The World Bank report was finished in April, but reportedly not published in order to avoid embarrassing the U.S. government, which has claimed plant-derived fuels have pushed up prices by only 3%. The report found biofuels has distorted food markets by diverting grain away from food for fuel, encouraging farmers to set aside land for its production, and sparked financial speculation on grains. A federal judge has ordered Google to turn over information about every user who's ever watched a video on YouTube. The ruling came as part of a lawsuit brought by Viacom over the posting of copyrighted material on YouTube. Google is resisting the request, saying it would allow Viacom to, quote, likely be able to determine the viewing and video uploading habits of YouTube's users. The Electronic Frontier Foundation called the judgment a setback to privacy rights. Leaders from Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, Russia, Canada, and the United States are gathering today in Hokkaido, Japan, for the start of the G8 summit. Protests have been occurring for days in the lead-up to the summit. Leaders of indigenous communities have urged wealthy nations to include indigenous people in discussions as they deal with climate change. This is Victoria Tolikorpus, chair of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Rights.
We have contributed the least to climate change, but we are carrying the heavy burden of solving the climate change problem, no? And so we would like them to ensure that we are included in the negotiations of the Climate Change Convention so that we can contribute more substantially in shaping solutions.
On Sunday, the South African-based Global Call to Action Against Poverty held a demonstration in Saipuru. Kumi Naidu urged the G8 nations to help the world's poorest people.
The reality is, in Africa, every single day, 6,000 people die from HIV/AIDS alone. Another 7,000 people die from malaria. Another 2,000-3,000 die from tuberculosis. If those numbers of deaths were happening in Europe or North America, we are convinced the G8 a long time ago have found the money to address these issues. So we want to see the same kind of urgency.
Meanwhile, Japan is being accused of detaining international activists ahead of the G8 summit. On Friday, 20 Korean farmers were detained on the northern island of Hokkaido. Several prominent international critics of the G8 were also blocked from entering Japan, including political scientist Susan George and Ladinda Napoli, the Asia-Pacific coordinator for Jubilee South. On Saturday, at least four people, including a Reuters journalist, were arrested during a heavily policed demonstration in Saipuru. Police were seen shattering the window of a sound truck and dragging out the driver. New questions are being raised over the Colombian military's rescue of kidnapped Colombian politician Ingrid Betancourt and 14 other hostages held by the rebel group FARC. Swiss radio is reporting leaders of the FARC rebel movement were paid $20 million to free the hostages. According to the report, the hostages were actually ransomed for a high price and whole rescue operation was a setup. Colombian officials have denied the report. The Israeli army